Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher. You've probably heard about the cloud by now, that apparently benign storage facility in the ether for our computer files, photos, music, and more, there for the tapping at a moment's notice. But author and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Matt Richtel, in his latest novel, has considered a darker side to the cloud, our addiction to the information it holds, and our addiction to the technology that's needed to reach it. New York Times reporter Matt Richtel is with us now from San Francisco to talk about his new book, The Cloud. Welcome, Matt.
Well, thank you for having me.
You've said that humans have adopted mobile computer technology at a rate that simply has no precedent. And I was wondering, what do you even compare it to?
Yeah, great question. You try to compare it to things like the Gutenberg press or the TV, and there's kind of a nuance to it. We don't exactly know how quickly those things were adopted. But we do know that there is a major material difference in this technology from everything that came before, and that is its interactive nature. And so when you push and tap, something happens. That moment, that interactivity so ballyhooed by the technology makers, has some really powerful neurological implications.
Yeah, and let's talk about that. The bottom line is the question of what the technology is doing to the brains of our children who have literally grown up with at least a cell phone in the house. What are your concerns about?
Underscore at least.
At least, absolutely.
at least.
I mean, and if not, heaven knows what nowadays. Multiple platforms. What are the concerns? Tell us about those physical manifestation of this in the brain.
Yeah, just to draw a quick distinction, the cloud is I'm about to describe some real stuff, some real science. The cloud is a fast-paced kind of thriller that takes this to another level, so I don't want to totally conflate these things.
Yes.
But the research would suggest that a few things about what happens when we interact with our devices and when our children interact with our devices, and would you permit a small primer, you may well know it, on how the brain digests information and how we focus and attend to things?
Sure.
Okay. So it goes like this, and I'm really oversimplifying it. All the neuroscientists in the audience can throw stuff in the direction of San Francisco. But basically, you've got this frontal lobe. It's the last part of the brain to develop. It's critical for focus and attention. And then you've got so when you and I are having this conversation, we are really focused and using this part of our brain. It's called executive control. But it is under a lot of duress from a very and arguably even more important part of the brain for survival. And that's the reptilian sensory cortices at sort of the base of our brain. This is the stuff that sends a message every time we hear something or see something. It sends it to that control center at the front of the brain that says, should I reorient? So can I just take us back a few hundred thousand years to the jungle to give you an example?
Okay.
All right, quickly, and then I'll tell you about your kids because this is relevant background. You're in the jungle. You're building a hut. You're using your focus, and then a lion comes in the corner of the village, and your sensory cortices say, quick brain, lion, run. Great. Okay, very important survival. But guess what? If you've got something constantly pinging at you, it's as if you don't know whether you're getting lions or you're getting threats or you're getting opportunities, constantly saying to the control center of your brain, reorient, reorient, reorient. Pretty hard to focus. Even harder, Anne, if you're talking about kids, because your kids' frontal lobes are not fully developed yet. So what I start to get into in the cloud is, what happens if you take an immature brain and give it maybe the most powerful personal technology the world's ever seen?
So the idea is that it's not only hard to focus, but it's damaging our ability to focus, at least our children's ability.
And that's the stuff that the researchers are looking at, is whether it's actually damaging their long-term ability to focus. We know in the moment it's hard to focus, and what could be more telling of that than trying to drive a car while texting? Research going basically back to World War II shows the limitations of the brain to focus on more than one stream of information at a time. Now, I do in no means want to make this an anti-technology rant, because it's not. If you use this stuff well, you are deeply empowered. What I've tried to do in the cloud, beyond having just a heck of a lot of fun,
that's okay.
And writing what I hope is a gripping,
I read it.
I should not pat myself on the back too much. I just broke my arm, but it's a sort of a fast paced thriller. I had the opportunity to ask, what if this is going even further and deeper than we now realize? What might it be doing to us? And I think it at least has the potential to do exactly what you say, really change the brains of our children.
And furthermore, you make an important point at some point in the novel, I can't remember now, but that this is not controlled by government. This is not controlled by our hospitals or the people that care for our children or the educational system. It's controlled by private entities that want to profit from it.
And here's their incentive, Ann, to keep you on their sites and using their devices as much as possible. They want our eyeballs. I know that term is a little bit dated at this point, but the more they keep us on, the more they show us their ads and the more we give them fees. So that means that these folks are perfecting the idea of keeping us online and engaged in their stuff, even if by engaged they mean switching attention all the time. Can I just give you one interesting thing about how the marketing of this has become so seductive?
Yes.
You know, I can't think of another technology or substance, if you will. I tend to think of the device even as a substance that we want to use so compulsively and might have some downsides that gets marketed under the guise of productivity. So the message to us is the more you're on, the more you're productive. Well, the reality is if you're on too much, not only is the other stuff I said to you potentially true, it is also potentially true that you're missing out on some downtime that is essential to letting your brain rest, that is in turn essential to productivity. You're missing out on some downtime that is essential to, say, having conversations with your spouse that might be essential to the health of that thing. However, the way it's marketed is use it, use it, use it. You'll be smarter, you'll be richer, you'll be whatever. That's not actually true.
You have a parallel story going on in the story about the protagonist is injured at the beginning and he has a closed head injury, a concussion. And it affects his thinking throughout. And there's sort of that parallel construction going on with what the technology is doing to the brains of the children. There's no time to repair and rest.
I'm really grateful you asked that and recognized it in the story, because let me just turn to the art side of this for a second. What I really try to do in these stories, what is the most meaningful thing to me as a writer, is to show and not tell, to illustrate and not shove down someone's throat. I could have well written a rant about these things, and Lord knows I'm probably your listeners have put on earmuffs at this point due to my
ranting.
but yes, I really have tried to show through a parallel story what is happening to our brains, to make a really emotional narrative that is just fun and interesting to read, not where you're getting a bunch of science thrown at you.
When I was working from some notes I had scribbled in my paperback of your book, I used my iPhone to weigh down the pages so that I could copy something into my computer. And you talk about our connectedness to our phones and the feelings we get when, like, the power starts to fade and that sort of thing. Like, we have to take care of it. We have to take care of it.
There's a couple bits of science related to that, too, and two that come to mind in particular. One is the researchers talk about getting a dopamine squirt from your when you use your device. So if you tap it, I'd prevail upon your listeners to just try this, to sink down into the feeling when you're using your device and recognize the little burst of adrenaline you get. You get a burst of adrenaline. You do it more. In its absence, you feel bored. So that device is kind of a delivery mechanism for neurochemicals. No wonder you start to feel bad when the power goes. And here's another way to think about that. It also has become this thing that is a little bit like a lottery ticket. When you scratch a lottery ticket, you never know if you're going to get something good or bad, so you get a little bit of excitement. It's a kind of, or you go to a slot machine in Vegas. There's a kind of an addictive property that psychologists call intermittent reinforcement. When's the good thing going to happen? With your device, you never know when you're going to get the good email. Most of the time, it's, you know, the president of Zimbabwe offering you $1 million for your Social Security number. But occasionally, it's something good like, hey, Matt, NPR would like to have you on the radio. So I'm incentivized to check it all the time. When that thing goes dark, you're starting to miss some of that powerful connection.
The protagonist in the book, again, Nat, clearly connected to his technology. He carries around a computer with him all the time. He's constantly Googling something. But there's a short story at the back of the book about a friend of Nat's who is not exactly anti-technology, but certainly ambivalent about it, doesn't even own a computer or a smartphone.
Yes, and seems to be really driven by his guts and his muscle and would probably prefer to fight with his fists rather than be in a flame war online. And he winds up also discovering, finding himself in the middle of a quite a conspiracy involving what's happening to our data. The story's called Floodgate, what's happening to our data in the cloud.
Do you want to talk at all about the fictitious technology you introduce in the story? The jugglers?
I don't know, because it's such a... You read the book. You tell me, how much of a spoiler is it to get into that?
Well, probably some. I mean, I guess what I should ask, you're a technology writer. You write for the New York Times about how technology affects us in our everyday lives and so forth. Where did you go to? How did that? We don't have to tell people what it is, but what inspired you to conceive it?
Well, I'll give you a couple things. First of all, the juggler is some technology in here that that I don't think is all that far-fetched, and yet is also, I hope, a little bit mind-boggling in terms of how powerful it is. I think it's around the corner. It was not all that hard to conceive of when you're steeped in this stuff. I just want to tell you one little side note about the juggler. The name of this book was originally called The Juggler. And for two reasons, HarperCollins, my publisher, said, we can't do that. One is, it sounds like a nemesis to Batman.
Exactly. I was going to say the Joker. Right, right.
Right. So, yes. And frankly, I don't know why we're running away from Batman. Those movies sell billions. welcome to the book publishing world. You try to find the things least effective. So that was one. And the other reason was that that we didn't do it is they, and I think to their credit, they realized that the cloud is really, really of the moment. And I love the metaphor, something that you alluded to earlier. The protagonist is in a cloud, is in an emotional and even neurological cloud, certainly a psychological one. And then we are all in a kind of a cloud. So that was why we walked away from the juggler the name and found the cloud, which I think is more apt.
I was going to ask you if there's any research to this going on now on this score, but I guess the whole point is they're out there testing it every day with our children.
Yeah, well, both things are true. They are testing it, and they are getting really positive reinforcement. I mean, look, the folks in there's a front-page story I did in the paper not too long ago. The people creating this in Silicon Valley are admitting now that they look at what they do as having a powerful neurological impact. You know, they used to call it usefulness. I'm not even sure, generally speaking, how we make these distinctions between useful and powerful psychological or neurological impact. It's almost like trying to create a distinction between the mind-body barrier. But the more important point here is Silicon Valley, the folks coming up with this, leaders at the companies that you know best are saying something really powerful is going on, and they're even telling their employees, hey, have some caution around how you use this stuff.
Well, Matt Richtel, thanks for joining us today to talk about it, and thanks for the title of your book, without which I would not have thought to call you.
Then it worked. I don't know. The juggler, you might have just gone and seen Batman and we would have never
met. Exactly. Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
Have a good day.
Matt is an author, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. His new book is called The Cloud. We'll continue Tech Tuesday when we return. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Amy Webb wanted to find a husband. She tried online dating, but there was a problem.
And it turned out that really the only thing that the dating sites were able to match me correctly on was zip code.
So she did the matching herself. I'm Kai Rizdahl, gaming the data to find your true love. That and the rest of the day's business news next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace tonight at 6 on 89.7 NPR News. 27 degrees with cloudy skies, a high of 33 today. There is a chance of some snow tonight, a low of 21. Mostly sunny and a high of 31 on Wednesday. Support comes from OSU's Museum of Biological Diversity, a research museum that opens its doors to the public once a year. Hands-on activities for all ages, live animals, tours, demos, and much more. Saturday, February 9th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Museum of Biological Diversity, 1315 Kinnear Road. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. When you're out with friends and everyone has a camera on their phone, it is pretty easy for photos of the night to end up in Facebook or Instagram by the next day. Sharing those moments can be a lot of fun, but sometimes the photo evidence of a particularly wild night could come back to haunt you in the form of a job search, if nothing else. Two OSU students have developed a new website called capstory.com with the idea of sharing photos outside the realms of the search engines. Joining us now to talk about capstory.com are the two co-founders, Supersana Mishra. He is a junior at Ohio State. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Also with us, Dustin Studer, another junior at OSU. Welcome to the show, Dustin.
Yes, thanks for having us, Ann.
So you call each site a capsule.
Yes.
Who wants to go first? Why a capsule?
I'll go first.
Dustin?
We played off the idea of a capsule because we've created a site where people can go on, they invite their friends, and you have these private spaces where you can then share with those specific groups of friends that you are adding. So in a capsule, all of your media is stored in one location, and that content is safe and secure, and we keep it forever.
I think of it as like a shell.
Exactly.
Unlike it. What inspired this in the first place? Are you guys just business guys and, you know, you're trying to find that niche like so many others, or
yeah, it's
did something
of a funny
personal?
Story how we got started. Our freshman year, we were randomly placed as roommates here at Ohio State, and we both started off pre-med, so we were in a lot of the same classes, got to know each other, and just so happens that in high school, both of us had started our own businesses. So we kind of had this passion for business that we hadn't really developed that much because medicine was our main focus. And then so we were always bouncing ideas back and forth, trying to think of the next big thing, think of what's coming up. And one time, our freshman year in the spring quarter, we took a spontaneous trip out to California to just hang out with some friends that we knew there, visit them, stayed on Stanford's campus. And when we were there, we were just inspired by Silicon Valley, everything that's going on there, all the innovation. And when we were out and about with all these people that we had never met before, that's kind of when we got the idea for Capstory, because the alternatives were go find 20-plus people on Facebook, friend them, put them into a group, somehow set all the privacy settings correctly, ask all of them to contribute, and we figured there had to be a better way, so we built it.
So how is it more secure? What's the bottom line? What makes it more secure than a Facebook? Couldn't I just, like you just described, start a Facebook page, but just limit?
The reason Capstory is more secure is Facebook, while you can go in and you can make those private groups, there's 27 privacy settings. And that can get very complicated for users. Facebook's always pushing out updates. Sometimes those updates can reset your privacy. So because there's a little bit of a challenge, and we were recognizing students around Ohio State no longer trusting Facebook's privacy, and even though you could potentially make a private group, you still don't have full faith that that content is secure. Somebody could still potentially Google for that image. So on CapStory, each capsule is a very private location. We use the same security, almost as if your bank account was being protected. So nobody can get into that capsule except the people that you invite.
Can the people that you invite into the capsule retrieve?
The people that you invite to a capsule also have access to that content. So you're inviting your best friends and hoping that they're not going to do anything bad with that content once you have it in that location.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm talking to two Ohio State University juniors who have founded a new company. It's called CapStory.com. It's being billed as an alternative to Facebook. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can tweet us at WOSU All Sides or go to our Facebook page yourself, which is not very secure. So go ahead, post away, but be careful. You can invite people to share to your capsule, but you can't necessarily control what they retrieve from that capsule, right? Ultimately, it's a faith-based premise.
Yes, definitely. Anything you really put on the internet, you can always find a way to grab it and share it more publicly. You can always take a screenshot or even a photo of your screen. So you never should share things that you don't really want and a lot of other people to see. And CapStory, as it's evolved, we found when we did a recent survey with our users, over 90% of people who use CapStory regularly, they kind of more use it just to keep in touch with friends. It's the everyday things that they like to share on CapStory rather than on Facebook. It doesn't necessarily have to be anything that they're trying to hide. It's just an easier outlet to, hey, this is just something that happened today. I really don't care for 2,000 people on Facebook to see all of it. Don't really care for my, you know, high school friends who I haven't talked to in a while to see everything that's happening with my life now. And that's kind of why they turned to CapStory.
I think a lot of people, when Facebook first came out, that was sort of what they conceived Facebook as. No one really thought about the fact that you're going to have lots of people you don't really know following you on Facebook.
Right.
What's to stop CapStory.com from becoming the same sort of entity?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, well, what we started off with is our basic premise is different than Facebook. On Facebook, you have one profile page, and you kind of add all of your friends and everyone you ever know onto your Facebook. On CapStory, just from the ground up, each capsule is completely separate. So you could have a capsule with all your coworkers here that stays totally separate from your capsule with all of your friends. So no matter how big CapStory gets, for you, the biggest it's going to get are how many other people you invite into your capsules.
And can I go to CapStory.com and find out whether, you know, Dustin Studer is there?
You do not know if I'm on CapStory unless I have invited you to one of my capsules. And just because I add you to one of my capsules does not mean that you will see other capsules that I am participating in. So as Supersana explained it, I can have a capsule just for my family and a completely separate capsule just for my friends. And the people in those two capsules, they don't overlap and they can't see that the other capsule exists.
Can you ever make a capsule just go away?
We actually, the person that creates the capsule, they're the capsule administrator, and they stick around forever in that capsule. But if somebody is participating in one and they no longer want to be a part of it or they'd like to get involved in something else, they can definitely get out of that capsule.
But the capsule is always somewhere in the cloud.
That is true.
Judy in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Judy.
Oh, hi. Thanks, Ann. I listen to your show every day, and I love NPR.
Thank you.
My favorite station. I just want to say that I think this is a very innovative idea. I am frankly sick of Facebook, and I have a lot of friends who are sick of Facebook, and I actually don't use Facebook. But I think this idea of just getting your close friends together and communicating and sharing ideas, I think it's wonderful. I just wish that these guys would figure out a way that if you don't want to friend somebody, or they're saying if you have a friend and they're kind of not following the rules, you could just get rid of them and then they can't get back on it. Facebook it's kind of like a disease almost. It can hurt people. And I think this is great for young kids who just want to share private things and have nice conversations. If I had money, I would invest in something like this. It's
so
a great idea.
You can uninvite people, right, Dustin?
Yes, you can. Once you've created that capsule, and if somebody is participating and they're doing things that you don't want them to be doing in that capsule or you don't trust them anymore, you can definitely kick them out and they no longer have access to that content.
Is it, thank you, Judy, for that call. We appreciate it. Is it interactive? In other words, is everybody talking to each other? And is it, it looks more like a photo album or feels more like a photo album than it does sort of that Facebook posting what I did today kind of a thing?
Yeah, we definitely built it for interaction. That's the whole idea that you have this one centralized location for every group that you have in real life where you can interact with them. And yes, it's basically a group photo album where everyone can post photos, quotes, memories, stories, whatever it may be. And each piece of content you put on there, you can comment back and forth. Everyone can add new things. It's just a great place to be yourself.
How are you seeing the usage of this differ from Facebook? Any differences besides the random people that are your friends on Facebook?
Right. As you mentioned earlier, it's become a place where people are just sharing all that everyday content that doesn't necessarily fit in on other social media platforms. So it's more consistent engagement throughout the day. I take a picture of a nice meal that I had that might not fit in on Instagram, but I want to share it with my friends, mm-hmm. or some random story that happened, something funny in class that I want to share with my friends.
I suppose it's one of those places, too, where you could say, I'm going to be gone this weekend. If anybody sees anything funny going on at my house, let me know. Whereas you would never want to post that on Facebook.
Exactly.
So if someday an employer asks you for passwords to your social media sites to check on them, which they do now, and which, and if you want the job, you have to pony up, do you have to give them this? Is this protected from that?
From our end, we, if an employer ever made a request to access a user's account, we'd never comply with that unless they had some sort of warrant or something.
Well, but, that's a person. Yeah, right.
Right, right. And for individuals who are on CapStory, well, they have all of these capsules that are kind of completely separate. And since CapStory is just getting started, I don't think it'll be a problem for employers asking them about it yet.
But you could say you could give them your Facebook password, but not CapStory, because they can't find you on CapStory.
Exactly. If they find you on Facebook, they can say, well, we know you exist. We saw your profile. So we'd like your password. Whereas on CapStory, there's literally no search function. There's no profile page. Nothing that could lead an employer or just random people from finding you on there.
Also, I think possibly one of the great things about CapStory.com is that you don't have to have an app. You can just text something into it and start a capsule.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we did that on purpose from the beginning. We wanted to make sure that everybody could participate and everybody could use CapStory. So as long as somebody had a phone that could text a friend, they could use CapStory. So we built it off of a system where texting into submit@capstory.com, which is an email address but works just like a phone number, you can send in pictures, you can send in quotes, and now we can even support video for people to send in.
But if you don't have a smartphone and you don't have an iPad or yep. you don't have easy access to a laptop or something like that, how do you see what you see on capstory.com if all you're doing is ever texting in?
Right.
Yeah. Well, okay. If you don't have a smartphone where you do need to have a desktop computer or a laptop or something,
eventually you want to look at it.
Right. And that's how you would look at it eventually, is you can submit through texting or you can even submit on your computer. But eventually you need to get on some sort of device that's connected to the internet to kind of check all that stuff out.
So how long has this been out there?
So we've been working on the idea now for about a year, and we just took it live around Ohio State's campus to get some students to test it out in October. So as of the first of this year, we finally opened it up to the rest of the public.
And how many people are on it?
Well, technically, we're not supposed to disclose because we have investors, but
okay.
growth has been great. We've been seeing 10% week-over-week growth because people are kind of getting on there, getting acclimated to it, slowly understanding, oh, this is what I can use it for, and then inviting their friends. And then they can see that, oh, I can make another capsule for all my work friends.
So when I go onto CapStory.com, am I going to see the same sort of ad real estate given to ads is that the hope as you would on Facebook?
No, there's no ads on CapStory.
How can you pay for it then? What's the revenue
Great
stream?
Question. Yeah, well, because we've built this technology out from texting that doesn't really exist anywhere else, we can expand it to other verticals where if you think about the corporate world, where they might be collecting media from around the country, that obviously if it's inventory or something like that they can't post publicly, well, they can just have a capsule that's private, that's corporate labeled on their own servers, where they can kind of submit all their content, review it, and use it as part of their process.
But how do you pay? I mean, what's the revenue? How do you?
Well, the corporate side of the things, they would pay for.
But individuals?
Individuals will not pay for it. It's totally free, and we plan on keeping it that way.
Hmm. So if you have a quick call, we can try to squeeze it in, 614-292-8513. And Melissa in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Melissa.
Hi. This sounds like a great idea because I love Facebook, and I'm not a very private person. I've been a blogger since, like, 2004, back when blogging was just starting, and I was one of the first ones to get on Facebook back when you had to be invited and through your college and everything. But recently, I haven't liked where Facebook has been going because it's just become so political, and everyone just wants to post all of these political things, and no one wants to actually share what's going on in their life. And I am still, I feel, one of the few that post, like, this is what I did today, this is what's going on in my life. And then I get accused of, quote-unquote, oversharing quite often, and I'm like, well, yep. How can I overshare if this is the point of the application? But it doesn't seem like that's really what it is. So this seems better because then I could overshare with those I want to overshare with, and then everyone else wouldn't be so accusatory of me sharing so many things to everyone.
In other words, you didn't change, Facebook changed.
Yes, that's how I feel. I feel like it's just become this place where no one wants to share anything, and it's just so superficial. And then, you know, my husband doesn't want me to share this or that because his work friends might see that. And then I don't want to share this or that because this person might see this, and how would that make them feel? And so, you know, that seems better to be able to have kind of more groups that you would share with. That makes sense to me.
Good. That's great to hear. Yeah. You don't really have to worry about people yelling at you for just being yourself.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, Melissa, thanks for your call. You're like, you know, like a pioneer. You called in. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you. Well, I appreciate what you guys are doing. It sounds fun.
Thank you.
Take care. When you add someone to your capsule, can they automatically start texting in media to your capsule?
Yes.
Right away.
Okay. And then when you start texting the media, do you by then automatically create your own account, your own capsule?
As soon as you are invited to a capsule by a friend or a family member or a coworker, you will receive an invite message that will give you a unique at tag, and that at tag designates where that media is going to show up on your CapStory account. So if you've been invited to participate in a capsule, I will receive a text message that says, okay, here's the at tag that I need to use to text into that capsule. And when I use that at tag with a piece of media, either a picture or a quote, it will automatically show up in that capsule.
And if you don't want to be involved in CapStory.com, don't accept the invitation?
Yep, that's exactly right. And if you're not a user right now and someone invites you, you'll just get a temporary username and password to log in and check it out. If you don't want to, you don't have to.
So there'll be no people just sending stuff to your...
Definitely not. Okay. You will not get spammed.
Okay. That was another question. Okay, spam. All right. Well, thanks for joining us today to tell us about it. It's interesting. We appreciate your time.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you.
Two OSU juniors, Dustin Studer and Supersana Mishra, they are co-founders of CapStory.com. Of course, we'll have a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, Russell Holly from Geek.com. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Michael Apted, the director of 56 Up, the eighth in a series of documentaries that has followed the lives of several British men and women every 7 years, beginning when they were 7 years old. Also, we talk with Rebecca Luker about her new album of songs by Jerome Kern. She starred in Broadway revivals of Showboat and The Sound of Music. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
In the 1970s and 80s, popular novels like Rich Man, Poor Man came alive in TV miniseries. These showcases of the big networks attracted millions of viewers and became cultural landmarks. Tonight on PBS, Pioneers of Television looks back at the history of the TV miniseries. LeVar Burton discusses his role in Roots, and Richard Chamberlain reflects on the Thornbirds. Watch Pioneers of Television, the miniseries. It's tonight at 8 on WOSU-TV. Clouds today, a high of 33, a chance of a little snow tonight, a low of 21 degrees. Support comes from the Columbus Laser and Cataract Center. Dr. Buran performs multifocal cataract surgery that allows for seeing up close, intermediate, and at a distance. Multifocal cataract surgery includes LASIK vision correction post-surgery if needed. The Columbus Laser and Cataract Center. More at 614-939-1600. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The maker of the BlackBerry has struggled since the rise of iPhones and Android phones. Now it's time for a turnaround, maybe. Last week they unveiled two new smartphones, and perhaps more importantly, the tech company RIM, R-I-M, officially changed its name to BlackBerry. Joining us today to talk about their chances in the marketplace is our regular guest and Geek.com tech blogger, Russell Holley. Welcome, Russell.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So you and I joke about names and so forth a lot on the show, and what companies name their technology and their gadgets and so forth. But was the name change in this case a good idea?
I think everybody knows what a BlackBerry is.
Mm-hmm.
Even people who have never used one, who have never even used a smartphone. That it's a name. It's a household name. Very few people, especially now, hear RIM and think of, the company that makes the BlackBerry phones. So it made a lot of sense in that, it was something that everyone was kind of already doing. But at the same time, it's going to be a little while before the name really means anything in the grand scheme of how BlackBerry is going to kind of refit themselves into this ecosystem.
Right, because right now it just calls to mind the BlackBerry, which is dated now.
Absolutely, and it's always been the smaller screen with the keyboard, and it's that kind of iconic design.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really interesting to see that they released these two smartphones, the Q10 and the Z10. And the Q10 is very much what you expect when you think of a BlackBerry. You've got that kind of candy bar shape with the keyboard on the bottom half and the screen on the top half. And it's a touch screen that allows you to interact with everything, but it's still only, half of the phone. Whereas the Z10 is all screen. There's no buttons on the front of the phone at all, not even a home button. And everything about the operating system has been updated to support, just using your fingers to do everything from closing applications to using the virtual keyboard that's provided on the phone. It's really an entirely different experience from both of these phones that you would expect from anyone who's ever used a BlackBerry previously.
So is it in a good way entirely different?
I think it's absolutely in a good way. The BlackBerry made a lot of really solid improvements when it comes to how you think about using a phone, especially with the Z10. It's all, a screen. It's a 4.2-inch screen, which is just ever so slightly larger than the iPhone 5. But the entire operating system is designed to use with one hand. And when you think about somebody using an iPhone or an Android phone right now, the most common thing that I see anyway is holding the phone with two hands and using both thumbs to go through and type as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases with Android phones, it's necessary because the screens are so huge. We've got, 5-inch screens coming in a lot of these phones now. But the entire operating system for BlackBerry 10 is built around holding the phone in one hand and doing everything from navigating the screen to using the keyboard with one hand, and it's done with a series of gestures. So you use an application and you're done, instead of, you know, looking for a closing button or you know, the home button on the bottom of the screen. You swipe up with your thumb from the bottom of the screen, and it minimizes the application and sends it back to your desktop. And it's a really natural feel to how you would go through and use the phone.
If you're just joining us, my guest right now, Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about BlackBerry, the company. And I guess they're still calling their devices BlackBerries as well? Well,
it
they're calling them Z10
kind of
and Q10, I guess. Right, yeah.
The operating system is BlackBerry 10, and the phones are called, you know, BlackBerry Z10 and BlackBerry Q10. So going with the way that we name, that we call out a lot of phones now, it would be the BlackBerry, BlackBerry Z10, and that sounded kind of silly. But
as if Z10 and Q10 makes a lot of sense, you know, once
and that's,
again.
That's really just kind of, you know, a standard that, you know, BlackBerry and companies before the iPhone really did with their phones, where they had these kind of code names as opposed to these other names. And really, when you think about how silly some of the names for Android phones have gotten in the past year,
yeah,
it's, you know, six in one, half dozen in the other as far as which one is better. But,
right.
You know, so we've got these, and they're really just the best way to handle, you know, people who are looking to move from the BlackBerry experience. You know, if you've been using BlackBerry, you've been watching as your friends have had iPhones and Android phones, and maybe it's a work-issued phone or something like that, you're going to feel like you have everything that, you know, these other phones have now. You know, the way that the photo app works for BlackBerry 10, just kind of all of the above. Significantly better experience.
We have an email from Rachel. She writes, I want to know what Russell thought of the BlackBerry Super Bowl ad. It said it was easier to show what it can't do in 30 seconds than what it can do. That seemed dumb to me. Thoughts? I did not see the ad, so I don't know what Rachel's talking about.
It was a really silly ad, and it was designed to get people to talk about it and really just kind of make sure everyone knew that the BlackBerry Z10 was something that existed. But really, you know, the application, it's really something that you... it's true in one way. When you think about the things that your smartphone is capable of right now, and then you think about someone who has a BlackBerry, you know, there's this kind of mental block where you've got this limitation in your mind. You think about, you know, surfing on a website or downloading an application or you know, even some things that we really kind of take for granted when it comes to using the camera on an iPhone or an Android phone. A lot of those things before the BlackBerry Z10 weren't things that you could do on a BlackBerry very well. It wasn't an enjoyable experience at all, especially when it came to trying to go to websites and you know, that kind of thing. So it was a kind of a fun way for BlackBerry to make sure that everyone knew that, you know, the new BlackBerry as it was coming out is just as capable as these other phones. And, you know, when you've got 30 seconds of Super Bowl time, you really have kind of two options. You can make people laugh or you can make people think. And As the person who emailed pointed out, you know, it gets you talking, even if it's not very good.
Yeah, good point. Yep. I didn't even know about it before they said it. Let's turn our sights. Well, what are your predictions just generally about the whole BlackBerry thing? I mean, they're going up against, obviously, some, you know, huge entities, Apple, Android. Do you think there's room?
I think that there's definitely room, but not when it comes to competing with Apple or Android. I think it's important to understand that we have, you know, a lot of these other operating systems that are running right now in a lot of different markets. We have Windows Phone that's been trying to kind of carve themselves a niche out of this ecosystem, and we've got some other things coming from Mozilla's Firefox OS and a couple other places. And I think that, you know, even having only been a week old at this point, BlackBerry 10 is far more accessible, easier to use, and has, you know, a superior hardware, in my opinion, to a lot of these other phone manufacturers. So I think what we're looking at right now is for BlackBerry 10 to kind of be in third place. And I think that that's an important thing for people who are kind of tired of the iPhone versus Android argument to understand that there is a third option that is in many ways just as good.
Okay, so Microsoft's newest operation system, Windows 8, we've talked about it before, has a strong focus on the touchscreen experience, and now they have a new tablet available called the Surface Pro. You've foreshadowed this. What do you think?
So I played with their first release, which was the Surface RT. It was kind of an iPad-like introduction to Windows 8, and it had, you know, some problems. It wasn't particularly great, but the hardware was really, really good. The tablet felt amazing in my hand, and it was, you know, it had a keyboard that snapped on. If you've ever seen the commercials for it, it's really kind of a unique concept. And the Surface Pro is, you know, the professional version of that tablet, where it has a much faster processor and more RAM, and is just all around more capable. The tablet comes out on Saturday, and really it's designed to just be, you know, what you would expect from an Ultrabook right now, but with a touchscreen and a stylus for you know, taking notes and things like that. It's really, you know, supposed to be from the ground up a much more powerful machine.
And the dimensions of it and so forth are similar to the iPad?
They're fairly similar to the iPad. You've got what's essentially a 10.5 or 11-inch piece of hardware. It's a little thicker than the iPad, but it's capable of doing everything that you would do on a Windows laptop. You have a proper desktop that you can run whatever browser you want. You can install anything from video games to, you know, Microsoft Office on the tablet, and use, you know, either your fingers or mouse or the stylus that comes with it. There's a lot of, you know, functionality there that's not available in other places.
Yeah, so this is Microsoft's first tablet to make full use of Windows 8 now, right?
That's correct.
What wasn't getting used before?
How do you mean?
Well, what else does it do that the Surface didn't do?
So when you look
in terms of Windows 8.
When you look at Windows 8, you've got, you know, kind of two basic parts right now. You've got the desktop that you're used to from Windows 7 and Windows XP, and then you've got this start menu environment where you have applications that run on top of the start menu and you know, can basically run inside of the start menu. It's easy to think of Windows RT or Surface RT as just the things that happen on the start menu.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just those applications. You can't install programs like if you wanted to install Chrome, or if you wanted to, you know, install a video game that came out last week, you wouldn't be able to do that on the Surface RT because it was running a processor that's closer to what you would see on the iPad.
So is this something you endorse, or?
This is something that I've been really excited with. I haven't spent a whole lot of time, you know, outside of, you know, demonstrations with someone from Microsoft, you know, holding it and making sure I didn't do anything dangerous with it. But I will more than likely be in line Saturday morning to pick one up for myself.
And how much do they cost, speaking of picking one up?
They are going to be $899 for the 64 gig version, mm-hmm, and $100 more for 128 gigabytes.
All right. Now that's kind of expensive, isn't it?
It's right around the same price you would see for Ultrabooks right now. And that's okay. Really what you would compare this to, is an Ultrabook as opposed to an iPad.
Okay. All right. All right. So this isn't usually something people think of at Valentine's Day, but what kind of tech gifts are out there for Valentine's Day? What says romance in the tech world?
It depends on how far you go. There's so many silly things that happen for Valentine's Day in the tech community. You can either get really, really geeky, or you can, you know, just kind of, you know, have silly, you know, gift cards and things like that. But I think the weirdest thing that I've seen so far this year that's crossed my desk is a coffee shop in Japan that is actually doing 3D printed chocolate molds of people's faces.
From anywhere in the world?
You essentially sit down and you have a three-dimensional scan of your face done either with a 3D camera or, you know, special equipment, and you send it to them, and they will print your face as one of the chocolates in the heart-shaped box of chocolates in the center, so that when, you know, you're whoever you give this box to, whoever you think deserves the gift of your chocolatey face, you know, they open this box, and that's what will be, you know, in the center of the assortment of chocolates is your face.
Have you seen an example of this?
I have seen an example of
this.
And
is it creepy?
There's an example of this on geek.com, and it's a little disconcerting. I'm not going to lie. I can't imagine, you know, my wife coming. I can't imagine coming home and my wife handing me a box and it having her face in chocolate. I'm not really sure how I would respond to that. I'm sure I would seem appreciative on the surface, but that is a little over the top for me, I think.
Although it is an example of how to use a 3D printer in a practical way. I mean, sometimes I still kind of grapple with what are people doing with 3D printers? And I've seen lots of examples, but okay, a piece of chocolate, you could do
sure.
that.
If you're in the mood to make a custom piece of chocolate, it's, you know, the chocolate would get pushed out in much the same way that a tube of frosting would.
Mm-hmm.
So it would get printed in that same way, where it would make the three-dimensional stack of dots basically.
Like extruded.
Right, of heated chocolate, and then it would cool in the shape of your face.
What else? That's the weirdest. Anything short of, more interesting than a gift card, but...
Oh, so there's a website that's one of my favorite things to go to just to see silly things. It's thinkgeek.com, and they have an incredible supply of crazy kind of geek-related Valentine's Day things, including... people who are fans of the Portal video game. One of the interesting aspects of the Portal video game is that you have an open and closed portal, and you move through one to go to the other, and they're different colors. And there's everything from earrings to matching wrist, bracelets and things like that that are in those matching colors. So you've got the blue on one side and the orange on the other.
In those virtual games, do they celebrate holidays?
A lot of them do. You think about World of Warcraft and games like that.
Yeah.
They have a lot of holidays. Like they do special things during Christmas. World of Warcraft is one that for Valentine's Day one year, they had a special item that you could only pick up during Valentine's Day that when you threw at someone, it changed the shape of the person they were to make them look like a scantily clad lady that every computer-controlled person in the area would then follow that person around for the next, 10 or 15 minutes.
I thought you were going to say it was something like rip their heart out or something.
No, nothing that bad. It's just, it's one of those things where it kind of provided an occasional annoyance because the entire town full of people would then follow you around as you went to do things for 10 or 15 minutes.
Anything else? What do you get your spouse for Valentine? Well, you don't want to say, though, on the air. I did this to you with the kids.
She's actually listening today, so I can't say that.
But
whatever it is, it's going to be amazing, I promise.
Do you get a lot? I mean, is Valentine's a big holiday in the tech world?
Valentine's Day is not a big holiday in the tech world. It's usually, it kind of is and it isn't. This is, for tech reasons, this is right around the time where a lot of new things are announced and released. And so... a lot of companies, Best Buy and those Newegg.com will use this as an opportunity to put on kind of the first big sale of the year, where you can get things like that. And that's really only for people who think it's appropriate to get your significant other a $600 laptop for Christmas or for Valentine's Day.
Right.
You had to have messed up pretty bad, in my opinion, to get a $600 laptop for your spouse for Valentine's Day. It could just be me.
Not very romantic, although I would think it's something that you would appreciate, but maybe not. So... Well, Russell Holly, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Russell Holly. He's a tech blogger for Geek.com. He joins us every Tuesday on Tech Tuesday. Thanks to our all-side staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, associate producer Rachel Quimby, assistant producers Corinne Gleckler, production assistants Karim Shaban, Rose Joe, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.